Welcome to the Inspiring Leadership podcast series. This is aimed for you aspiring leaders, whatever level you're at, whether you're beginning out in your careers as managers and leaders, whether you're in middle ranking roles, or whether you're CEOs and chairmen of boards, there's always something we can all learn. And it's particularly the skills, stories, tips and techniques that you can pass on to those you lead and your teams.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Inspire Leadership podcast. I'm really delighted to do almost like a double act, but he is my guest. And my guest is a very special man who I've had a lot of respect for, known for a number of years. Because of his background and the way he's used his background to bring it into the foreground and the way he shows up with people. So Andrew Griffiths served 22 years in the Royal Navy, left in 2010 to run his own leadership practice. He's also a very successful associate at Duke Corporate Education, and that was how we met each other. He was far more successful than me. He got chosen on loads of programs. He was very popular. I never got chosen once. I think I must have learned a lesson from that. And he's a partner at Strengths Unleashed. He's a father of four and a grandfather of two. And he lives in Southsea on the South Coast. He's passionate about travel. I do share that one among many things we share. Mm-hmm. He's visited over 100 countries, and I think there's only something like 162 to visit. So he's doing. He's an active sport. He loves being in the outdoors and is endlessly curious about what's going on in the world and how it affects leadership. And the reason, before I pass over to him, that I wanted him to be with me on this is that he's got also a wealth of experience in his field. We share a similar field. We want to bounce some ideas and some practical tips that you listening around the world in 125 of those countries would find useful in your own leadership. So over to you, Andrew.
Jonathan, thank you very much for that introduction. And I said that I'd like to bounce that back and just remind people of who you are. So if I may have the honour just to introduce you, Jonathan Bowman Perks, served in the British Army for 20 years and is now an executive coach and trusted advisor to CEOs and top teams. Also a broadcaster and podcaster, quite prolific. I think you've done over 260 of those now, so I'm really impressed by that. And above all, you're a husband, a father, a grandfather, and a brother. And the other piece of information which I really like, which I think makes you pretty unique, is that you hold the Cypress Double Mountain Marathon World Record. I'm not sure whether you have a trophy or a medal for that.
Johnson. I do. I have a little boot somewhere, a tiny little brass boot. Goodness, where's it gone? But yes, that's a little thing I did.
Okay. One of the things, Jonathan, I know I'm going to sort of steal a bit of thunder here, but I thought for the benefit of your listeners that I would just like to share a little bit of our common history. Because one of the things I've really enjoyed about getting to know you is that every time I hear you mention things, it suddenly fires up my memory. And I think, gosh, I've done that. It's very similar to my experience. So here are a few things that I think people might find interesting. Both our fathers served in the same ship back in the 1950s, which was HMS Belfast. And I know your father was an aviator. And I think he served probably at the same time my father was also one of the ship's companies. So we go back a long way. We were both boarders at boarding schools. And then we both went into the military for very similar amounts of time. And we both left to pursue our second career in one of our great passions, which is around leadership and also coaching. I think on the personal side, this also strikes me quite hard as well. We've both lost parents. I know you lost your father in tragic circumstances. I lost both my parents at a fairly young age, both to cancer. And we've both lost a brother, which I think, again, is fairly unusual. And then on the sort of personal side, again, we've both been divorced. We both have two daughters. We both now have grandchildren. And I think also the thing that marks us out, Jonathan, is that we're really into this idea of what I would call the last journey, which is the journey into ourselves. And what does that mean for us and for our leadership styles? And around that also is that interest in looking in the past, which is around the idea of stoicism, the idea of being a good stoic as a leader. So I just wanted to share some of those similarities, because I think it's through serendipity that we sort of come together and we can have this opportunity to talk about some interesting things that I hope your listeners can take away as well, you know, to think about as a leader.
Yeah, well, Andrew, it's really great and very touched. And as you began to, over time, share a few photographs of, you know, HMS Belfast, which now is, for those listening around the world, it's become a historical ship, as in it's in the Thames, opposite the Tower of London. And people can go and visit it and see how things were and listen to recordings of, you know, people being patched up on board in the Korean War when my father was a midshipman doing that. And you can hear various other things. And I was really honored to be able to give a talk to one of my clients, Tetra Tech, on board HMS Belfast.
Interesting.
And I took my old father's cap, naval cap, which you still have yours, and it's at the back there. And I just popped it on, and it happens to fit like a glove. Mm. So that's a bit uncanny. But yeah, a really nice connection, and particularly with being as fathers of four and grandfather of two children. Curiosity was a thing that came up a lot in both of our discussions. Hang on, I'm just going to check my dog's not. What are you doing over there? He's eating half my flower arrangement. I'm not quite sure what it is. What is it? Come here. Come here. What do you do? just bear with me a second. We had a natural pause there where I managed to stop my puppy dog eating his way through some of my furniture in my room. Curiosity. My dog had curiosity with what he could, she could eat. Curiosity is really key. And you are very curious about the world. What do you see going on at the moment, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think to answer that question, I probably put a left-hand marker in terms of a sort of time frame. So if I think about the world sort of post-COVID, last couple of years, and then maybe the right-hand edge, just say to the end of this year, one of the things I'd say is I haven't changed, but I know I'm different. So when I look out the window, and this is something I think all leaders should do a lot more, particularly strategic leaders, is look out the window. What do you see? I feel there are three things that are global challenges right now and will challenge the way we think. The first one is disruptive technology. None of these, I don't think, will surprise anybody. Second one, I think, is the global economy, where we're heading with that. And the third is geopolitics. And putting those three together, I think, we live in a very divided, disjointed, and sometimes quite dangerous world. But I'd like to just say a few words, I think, about the first one, which is disruptive technology. And I'll also put my hand up and say, you know, I'm not a tech brat, I'm not a tech person. But when I begin to listen and understand more about things like generative artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, those types of things, what we're heading towards, and the language that people are using, is a point of singularity, which means that when we go beyond that, when technology goes beyond that, we don't really have control of it anymore. And if you think about the speed, the rate of progress that technology is going, that is giving rise to huge uncertainty. And I think that when you live in a world that is even more uncertain, then you get increased levels of anxiety and stress. And I think that's really important. But in terms of technology and the tech companies now, one of the things I believe is that tech companies are more powerful than government. And this is something that's been happening over a period of time. But one of the companies I think that most people may not have heard of, but I think is the most important company in the world right now, is a company called Palantir. CEO is a guy called Alex Karp, and he's working with generative AI to solve the world's problems. And if people are interested, just go on to Google or YouTube and listen to the sorts of things that he is saying, because I think that's going to have a huge impact on what the future looks like.
Andrew, on that one, Andrew.
Yeah.
Alex Karp, C-A-R-P, Palantir. How do you spell it?
Yeah, PALANTIR, and it's Alex Karp, KARP.
Right. Thank you for that. Yeah.
And I was going to go beyond mentioning that company into the broader church of social media, and bringing into that the idea of data and how we use data, because I see two challenges around this that people will instantly recognize. One is manipulation, and the next one is addiction around how we use data and what we use social media for. And the problem with manipulation is, of course, that we are becoming very polarized. And you only have to think about it in terms of leadership. You know, when you read articles now, you either get a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and people either like what you say or they don't like what you say. And I think this is really quite difficult, because the question we have to ask ourselves is, you know, so what is the truth? And I think that the way data and technology is driving this is that instead of saying what is the truth, people are saying, oh, well, what's the most plausible thing that you've heard? So I think there's some real challenges over that. And on the addiction side, if you look at the different generations that are using technology at the moment, I think the younger generation are becoming more and more addicted, not just to social media, but particularly the dreaded iPhone. And it's allowing us really to escape reality. And with these new technologies coming on board, you can imagine that there is an even greater chance that people are going to be opting, you know, out of the real world into a virtual world. So I think, just to summarize that, we reap what we sow. And I think it was Einstein, Uncle Albert, who said, you know, in the past, if we use the old ways of thinking to solve the old problems, we can't use the same type of thinking to solve the current problems. So going back to my thing, you know, I haven't changed, but I know I'm different. I think the challenge for a leader is to accept the world as it is and not what we think it ought to be.
Wow. No, I think, thank you, because I think that's a lovely, slightly different, but very fresh and very clear view of what's going on. Disruptive tech, global economy, geopolitics. And it's all very exciting, but yet it is all, for some people, very scary, that uncertainty and that, yeah, back to the Stoics, controlling the controllables. And that much of this we have no control over. I mean, to be honest, how much control do we have over things? I mean, I'm just at the moment chatting with someone to get solar panels put on the roof of my house. It's a big investment, mm-hmm, but within 11 years I will pay for it. I don't intend to go anywhere, so it makes sense to do that. And also an air source heat pump into my hot tub instead of the heater. Now, those are luxury things to be able to do on both of those. but I've got to that stage where, you know, I can now start plowing money back into save money, because we don't know what the future holds. But if I can control some of it and find some self-sufficiency, as well as not producing too much carbon emissions, along with having an electric car, I think those are some of the things you can start to control. But you either go with it or you try and fight it. And I think that's a really, I love your curiosity, and I love the fact that you haven't changed, but you are different. Very true. I mean, like people would say to you, you know, are you the same person you were when you were 10? Well, no, you're not. But you've learned a lot, and you've moved on with those experiences that you've had. Let's go to the next thought, Andrew. What do you think leaders need to, in this world we're in now, what do these leaders need to focus on to survive and to thrive? Terms that you and I both like, surviving and thriving, in the next decade, what's coming up? You know, how can we best prepare it?
Yeah, I think in terms of the leadership agenda, certainly the experiences I have working with senior leaders is I think the single hardest thing to do is to get them to think about, you know, what are the skills that you need to grow and develop to survive and thrive. And I put this in a neat little acronym, TAB or TAB. You'll probably know about tabbing from your army days. But if I explain, TAB is thinking, attitude and behavior. So if I just say a few words about thinking skills, and this goes to one of my major clients is a global hygiene company. And I run this program, and the first thing I say on day one is, you are all paid to think. All right. And I get this sort of stony silence. And I say, not only that, but you have to create the time to think. And I live by my sort of statement is less is more. Mm. And I love the American Special Forces quote, you know, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. So while the word becomes more and more complex and things get faster and faster, what I'm saying as a leader, you have to go the other way. You have to slow down. And that, I think, for most people is counterintuitive, and it's natural that people have difficulty sort of accepting that. But in terms of those thinking skills, not just taking time to think, but I think the way that you see the world naturally asks you to think about what are the right questions I need to ask. Mm. Because we're also programmed to always come up with answers. And there's always this pressure to provide an answer. But I think the real money, the way you stack the deck in your favor, is to say, okay, what are the right questions? So it's about knowing less, but wondering more.
Oh, I like that.
And when I was working with, you know, consultants, one of the top four consulting companies, I was saying you've got to subtly move from being the problem solver to the problem finder. You've got to move from hitting the current target to thinking about what is the next target. And I had a really nice conversation the other week with a young researcher who was working with a cheese company. And the cheese company said to him, we want to run a campaign that basically says 80% of people like to eat biscuits with their cheese. Can you go and do the market research and help the marketing campaign? And this young researcher turned and said, well, what will happen in 3 years' time when 80% of people won't be eating cheese because of the environmental effects and other agendas? And I thought that was a brilliant way. I call it the cheese question. Mm. All right. So it's not just thinking about what you're being asked to do now, but really sort of asking a tough question and getting people to think like that, I think, adds real value.
Just go back on that one because it's so interesting. Yeah. I want to really catch it. So the first saying you had was don't solve the problem. Was it find the problem? Is that how
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways around it, because I always say also the first idea is not always the best idea. Mm-hmm. Or the first answer is not necessarily the one that you should go for.
Yeah.
So you've got to have that agility to stop, I think, and pause and take the time to think and think about the things that we know about, you know, how you frame the question and how you see this. And I think that's where the real value is added.
I love that. And indeed, when I think back to out on the prairie in Canada, I was commanding 14 warrior armored fighting vehicles, and we were traveling at speed. It doesn't sound very fast, but it's about 35 miles an hour cross country, but it's very rough terrain. And you're bouncing up and down on the suspension of these things, and you're jerking around, but you're moving at speed, all these vehicles moving together. And then we had an active opposition force that was starting to fire at us with laser simulation, and we had to respond to it. Otherwise we'd be taken out, written out of the game, because mm-hmm. the simulators would turn off our sensors and therefore turn us down to idle speed and things like that. But we had to suddenly turn from going 35 miles an hour in that direction to suddenly chinking and going off at 90 degrees in a slightly different direction to engage the enemy. But we had to do that without losing momentum, what we call tempo. So keeping the tempo up.
Operations.
And I think that's almost what you're talking about, this idea of in the world we're in as leaders, that we're moving at speed in this direction, and then the pandemic hits. And who can keep up the tempo of moving from that direction to 90 degrees off at that direction, or even 180?
Yeah.
Does that have any resonance for you?
Yeah, it does. And I think it may help me explain the next thing around thinking skills, is particularly at the strategic level. I mean, I would hate to be working in a strategy team trying to come up with a strategy that's going to live beyond, say, 6 months at the moment. It's so difficult because the world is such a volatile place. But coming to your point, though, I mean, strategy for me is a skill, all right? It's not a document. And again, one of the things we try to get people to do in terms of develop the right thinking skills is, if you think about going back to that point where I made, we expect, you know, people to give answers. If you look at strategy teams, they're supposed to come up with a sort of a definition or a result and come to a point. Whereas actually what you want in real strategic thinking, based on the type of world that we live in, is you want to think about what are the odds, what are the chances, what are the trade-offs. So you're really after options and choices. And it was one of my bosses in my last job in the Ministry of Defence, and we were doing some work on a strategic defence review. And this boss said to me, he said, listen, I would rather be vaguely right than precisely wrong.
Wow.
Vagueness is my strength. Now, can you imagine, you know, with a bunch of sort of clever staff officers saying, well, what does he mean, you know, vagueness is my strength? Because we were trained to give point estimates, you know, we were trained to come up with the answers. But over the 2 or 3 years I was there, I really appreciated what it means to be in a strategic role where you've got to keep your options open. And I would say that any senior leader who is looking to recruit into innovation or strategy, you need that type of divergent thinker. Right. So you know what it's like in the military. You have plan A, but plan A certainly becomes plan B, and plan B will no doubt become plan C. But you've also got to have plan F as well. So I think that's for me, that's a crucial part of adding value at the strategic thinking level. And also, I think the thinking skills that we're talking about are equally as applicable to solving some of the big problems at the moment. So I was thinking about, you know, the NHS. Now, you can't solve the problems the NHS is facing by throwing more money at it. You've got to really rethink, you know, what is the NHS for? And how do you stop, you know, people turning up at the doors and trying to use all its resources? How can you change that into a different scenario? So interestingly, you know, talking about the Stoic side, I'm a great fan of Donald Robertson, who podcasts a lot, and him and a guy called Tim LeBon, both psychoanalysts, talking about how you can basically change the way people think about health based on the idea prevention is better than cure. So whereas now people are sent to the NHS for CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, that really is a bit of a sticking plaster, okay, over issues to do with mental health, depression or anger. But if you go the other way and get people to think about some of the Stoic ideas, you can certainly put people into a much better frame before they even need to go for extra help.
Yeah.
And the way I relate to this, Jonathan, you know, very personal thing is, you know, I suffer with lower back pain. And I know for a fact that when I'm grumpy and I'm tired and I'm not in a good mood, my back pain is a lot worse. So I actually believe I can think myself out of the pain.
Yeah, and I do love this whole idea of going upstream in the NHS. So I'm going to listen to that podcast with Don Robertson and Tim.
Yeah.
But I'm listening to The Doctor's Pharmacy by Dr. Mark Hyman. And he is a functional medicine doctor. Now, what do they mean by that? That they look at all the root causes of the multiple illnesses you have, and they go upstream and they go, well, actually, how about eat, move, sleep, breathe, focus? You know, are you going to work on what you're actually putting into your body? And that, you know, in America, 93.5% of Americans they have, you know, how do they their whole medical system, their bodily system, is not as healthy as it should be. There's a term I'll come up with later on. I've forgotten what it is. Metabolically unhealthy. And in 1950 in the UK, I'm reading Ravenous by this particular author, Henry Dimbleby. And he was saying in 1950, 1% of Brits were obese. Now, in 2022, last year, we're talking about 23.5%. Now, what went on? What went on? That's fully obese, not even getting that way. A lot of people are overweight, you know, over 50 to 60% are overweight. And so I think this is very interesting, this idea of moving upstream, because the NHS cannot cope. You know, what's the NHS for? I think you're right. Yeah. Can't cope. And that if we can start thinking about, as you say, Stoic philosophy, which interestingly, CBT is an underpinning of Stoicism without it being fully on it, because my stepdaughter is a psychotherapist. That will make a real difference. We take personal accountability rather than wanting the system to sort us out and go, here I am, I've arrived, and I've not looked after myself for the last 40 years. I'm completely shot through. You make me better. And the pharmaceutical companies go, oh, great, goody, goody, we'll give you lots of pills. And you know, everybody else then wants to make money out of you. And that's not the way we want to do it.
And I think it's a great link to my next one, my TAB, which was the about your attitude, is really choosing the right mindset. And I think this is really important for leadership as well. And the point that you can choose your own attitude, you have agency, you have choice. Yeah. Okay, and I really like at the moment the Jocko Willink thing, which is where he says discipline is freedom. And you read that and you think, hang on a minute, how come discipline is freedom? But the way it's explained, and it's quite obvious that if you apply discipline to what you do, and particularly when you're leading in uncertainty, if you apply discipline, you create choice and freedom. And the way it works for me at the moment, Jonathan, is, you know, my discipline is my morning routine. And I think you have a routine as well. So I will go for a walk or a run or a cycle. I will go through my gratitude talk, and I will basically seize the day on the first hour or 2 hours in the morning, because I know after that it's going to get completely chaos. And I apply that discipline to every aspect then of, you know, maintaining that piece of control, because I have control over that. And then the rest of what happens the rest of the day, you know, I start obviously with making my bed with Admiral McRaven, and it goes on from there. Yeah. So choosing your attitude, I think, is fantastic. And even in adversity, I love the story of Colonel Crichton Abrams in the Second World War. He was the guy who was CEO of a mechanized brigade in the Ardennes Forest, the Battle of the Bulge. And on this particular day, I think the weather and had been closing in for a long time, and they were surrounded by fog and mist, and basically they'd become completely lost. So he sends a message to General Patton, and he says, we are now completely surrounded to the north, to the south, to the west, and to the east. We can attack the enemy in every direction. And he sent that message out, and it was so motivating for his troops that he actually made up the 90 kilometers to rejoin the main force. But it just showed you, you know, in the fog of chaos, if you choose the right attitude, and I even say there's a bit of dark humor in there, but I think it can be really, really, it can help a lot. And my other point on the attitude side is that if you just focus on your circumstances, you will find excuses and plenty to complain about. And I come across this a lot in coaching, all right? You probably, hopefully, will agree, where people will tell you all of their woes and their problems because they're just focusing on their current circumstances. But if you choose to focus on your capabilities, okay, your thinking skills, your ways of reframing things, etc., the only option then is to get moving.
I love that. And just staying with that one, I mean, attitude, you know, knowledge, skills, and attitude, as they talk about when you're hiring, KSA, always hire for attitude. The knowledge and skills, you can train them in the knowledge and then in the skills, but you can't train them in the attitude. If their attitude sucks, as the Americans would say, you're never going to, you know, hire people for attitude, fire them for attitude.
Yeah.
Give them a chance to change their attitude. But often they might have a entitlement culture, or, you know, it's never my fault. It's other enditis, as we used to call it when I was in the Royal Signals and communications.
Yeah.
There's a problem at the other end. It's your end. Sort out the radio. Say, I can't hear you.
Yeah.
And then you find that you're on mute, which is often I often do at my end. But I do like that.
And then the last one, just to close the loop on that, was the thing about behavior. And obviously behavior is driven by how you think and what your attitude is. And the thing that really, I think, strikes home to make this so important is to realize that your behaviors are what people see. And leadership is a perception game. So whatever your intent is, the only thing that people will see is what you, how you behave. And whether your words follow your behaviors, et cetera. So I really encourage leadership and leaders to think about, you know, what is it that people see when they work for you, or they're being led by you, or they're in your team?
Yeah, stay with that.
Sure.
Because I think it's really interesting. Behavior is so important. And I remember firing a couple of associates, and I said, you know, your knowledge and skills is fine, but the way you behave when you suck up to the CEO whenever you see him, but yet the way you treat the lady on reception as if she's dirt under your shoe, and you know who I am,
that
behavior is unacceptable. And, you know, who you are, the way you're behaving, shouts so loudly, I can't hear what you're saying. So it's not working for me. But I think there's something else that comes on behavior. Not only what, this is it. It's not just what people see, it's what people hear, and particularly what they feel. Isn't there that famous quote? People forget what you say, they forget what you do, but they never forget how you make them feel. And I'm just dealing with a situation with a top team where there's someone who behind the scenes undermines anybody who's trying to move things forward. If it's not in his interest, his ego, if he's looking good, that's fine, he's with it, but he will leave people feeling very embattled and very lacking in trust. The whole environment lacks psychological safety because of the behavior of this one person. And yet he's like McCavity the cat. Whenever there's a crime scene, he's not there. You know, he pulled the pin out of the grenade, he rolled it into the boardroom, and he closed the door and waits for the explosion and the smoke to clear, and opens the door and goes, hey, guys, what's going on? Let me help you. And you go, bastard.
I think the thing about behavior and leadership behavior, and we know it should be aligned with being authentic and what your values and beliefs are. But I got an example I thought just be worth getting your view on. I don't know if you've heard of something called the Nolan Principles.
No. How do you spell that?
Nolan, as in N-O-L-A-N, the Nolan Sisters. Was it?
Yeah. What's the Nolan Sisters?
Right. The Nolan Principles were written as the behaviors, and not the culture, but the behaviors that were expected of politicians and people in public office. So let me just read some of these words to you, and you tell me whether you think our recent batch of politicians have fulfilled these principles. So the top five are leadership, integrity, selflessness, accountability, honesty, and openness. I mean,
oh my God.
How well are we doing when we look at public figures who are supposed to demonstrate those behaviors? And this is why I think is worth mentioning behavior, because we are so far away from what we want from people in public places. And even, you know, at the coaching level, and I pulled this out of Marshall Goldsmith, who I believe that you've done some training with, talks about the ideal three behaviors that he looks for in the ideal coachee. And those are courage, humility, and discipline. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, in all my time coaching, I would say that very, very few of the leaders I have worked with have actually exhibited all of those three behaviors. So when you look at the Nolan Principles, and when you look at Marshall Goldsmith's work, there's a behavior gap, isn't there, between where we aspire to be, where we think we're heading, and the reality and what we see. And based on what we see, as you said, Jonathan, that's the feeling we're left with.
Mm-hmm. No, and humility particularly is the one I find a number of leaders lack. They may have courage, that they're very bold sometimes, even reckless perhaps. They get the mix wrong there, but they may not have the real conversation with people. They'll sabotage them behind the back. They'll speak ill of people to somebody else in a whisper, but little knowing that person will then tell it straight to the person that they bitched about. But yeah, the humility, it's often what I've achieved, me, I've done all this. And as one person said to one young officer who was bragging about all his achievements, he said, "So when you were single-handedly saving the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, what was all the other officers and soldiers doing? I mean, they clearly weren't needed." I hope it's a lovely put it. And then discipline. Yeah, discipline. Mm. When I failed in life, it's through ill discipline and not sticking to my values or my integrity. And when I've been particularly successful, in spite of the situation, it's the discipline. And I think I know how you operate, and it's as a very fine leadership coach and strategy coach as well. That's a particular specialism you have. But I think it's always been, people have valued you and I bringing the discipline to a meeting or the way things are run, so they don't run off.
Yeah.
And they go down rabbit holes and destroy the whole purpose of the...
People who work for me, Jonathan, find me incredibly frustrating because I'm always on time. And I'm also very happy to do something called leadership through embarrassment.
Yeah.
So if someone is late, or, you know, I'll make a snide remark in jest, but it's sort of meant quite serious. But, you know, I guess you were the same. We were trained that if you are 5 minutes, or if you're on time, you're late.
Yeah. Yeah. And have you ever done the locking the door when meeting is done? I knew a couple of people who actually CEOs, they actually got the door locked when it was a minute past the hour. And then the people couldn't come in. You could see them looking through the window. And he goes, "Go away, come back next time." Yeah. And they wouldn't miss it then.
We had to do a walk of shame if you were late to my other colleagues' meetings, when you would get clapped in the room. So
I think that's good. Sure, because apart from the Mickey take, we're not trying to utterly humiliate people.
No.
It's more to get a healthier behavior that comes from people showing respect for others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when you're late, they can't start on time. So everything starts to get elongated. Yeah. So I just start, even if not everybody's there.
Yeah. And just going back to that thing about thinking, attitude, and behavior, those are basically the Stoic traditions. So the way I use those as my strong reference points, it helps me to read, review, and learn from, you know, what the Stoics were doing 2,000 years ago. And I think that's really great development, you know, for any leader, is to be curious enough about... Nothing new has come out of leadership for thousands of years. It's all been done before. If you seek, you will find some great great insights and advice.
Well, then, if you haven't read this book, General Jim Mattis, Course and Chaos.
Leadership. Well, he was a great Stoic.
He was, and he read thousands of books, and he expected all his Marines to read a lot too. And all leaders are readers, but not all readers are leaders.
Correct.
Very interesting. Well, look, I love that one. And your rule of three comes up quite a lot, and it serves you well. The next question I had was, you've talked to me before about your three shots that leaders should play. Can you tell me and those listening and watching, what are those three shots?
Sure. And a bit of context here, Jonathan, because when I talk about three shots, it's aimed at those people who are going through what I think is the biggest transition as a leader. When you go from being an operational leader and you climb up to being a strategic leader, what I see most people doing is they drag a lot of their operational knowledge and the way, you know, to get things done, they try to bring that into the strategic space. And of course, it doesn't work. So to help people navigate that, I go back to my maxim of less is more. You know, what are the three things? What are the three shots I need to play really well? And obviously using that sports analogy, if it's golf or tennis or soccer or basketball, whatever, I'm sure there are two or three things that you need to do really well. So the three things that I talk about, and this becomes very sticky language as well, is firstly to ask yourself, you know, where are you trying to get to? Where is your North Star? And I know people are probably familiar with this concept of the North Star. And the reason I like the word North Star, because I use it as a wrapper to talk about, you know, the strategy, the vision, the mission, all that sort of stuff. And the thing that I put across when talking about the North Star is it's also got that emotional element, right? You buy into where you're trying to get to. And if you want people to come along with you, you've got to have an emotional quotient to make it work. You know, it's a bit like Martin Luther King, who said, you know, I have a dream, four words, very, very packed with emotional content. He didn't say, I have a strategy. The impact is completely different, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the first shot is knowing where you're trying to get to. So the key question to take away is, you know, where am I trying to get to? Where am I going? And sometimes, you know, that's not easy to find. I think you detect it rather than you find it. Mm-hmm. And there's a very subtle nuance in there. Because if you look at all the stars in the sky, you know, you're trying to detect where the North Star is. You're not trying to create a new North Star or a new star, because there's thousands of them out there. So even when you're talking about personal purpose, and I spent a lot of time working out my purpose, and I had to do it very much in a therapeutic route. It took me a lot of grief and a lot of tears to work out what my purpose was.
And what is it?
Very simple. Yeah, it's to develop people.
And
I can condense it down to that, because it helps with all my decision making and who I want to work with, you know, because I asked that question, does it fulfill my North Star, which is to develop people, which means, can I connect with them as well?
Mm. It's lovely that how in your on your journey you've come up with that one, and in some people that's pretty simple, but you've distilled it all down. And mine is like on my books and my logos and everything, that's, you know, what it says on the tin is what it's about, is inspiring leadership. It's about inspiring leadership in others, finding inspiring leaders, learning from them, like you, drawing what we can, sharing it with others, but inspiring leadership wherever we go in others, so that there's better leaders following the Nolan principles. God, I love that. I so love that. I keep having a little rant, as you probably heard before, about certain people like Liz Truss and Boris, who are the antithesis of that.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
Trump as well. And just like they've rubbished all that we stand for, all the years of good leadership behavior, trashed overnight, crashed. Yeah. But
my second shot, we're on to the number two. So we talked about finding your North Star. The second one is to get to your balcony.
Mm.
All right. Now, it comes from the classic book, Leadership on the Line, Heifetz and Linsky. And there's the wonderful story of Marty Linsky goes to a dance with his wife at a local town hall. He's on the dance floor, and all he can see on the dance floor is this complete crowd of people. And he says, if he's lucky, he's listening to the music and he's trying to move with his wife but not bump into other people. And then halfway through the dance, he goes to the bathroom or the toilet. He goes up, and when he comes back, he goes out onto the balcony. And when he looks down, he sees a completely different perspective. He can see how people are moving around the dance floor. He can see people who are joining the dance floor, people who are leaving. He can even notice how the tempo of the music and the band affects the way that people are reacting to the music. And the analogy is great, because people, leaders, spend far too much time on the dance floor, fixing problems, being reactive. And if you want to be a leader who is able to think, you've got to create space and time to get on your balcony. Mm. And the balcony is a concept. I mean, it could be anything. Some people said to me, I get on my balcony when I go in the shower in the morning, or I walk my dog, you know, it's my balcony time, or the drive to work. But the simple fact is, if you're not getting to your balcony enough, you're not going to be able to add value in terms of whether that's being a strategic leader or a problem solver. And I think at the moment, most people are being burnt out because they're spending far too much time on the dance floor. So you've got to stop doing things, go back to our idea of behaviors. If this is a behavior you really want to grow, you've got to decide, what am I going to stop doing and what am I going to start doing?
I do love that one. And I went to Harvard and did one of their leadership programs. And Rob Heifetz, Leadership on the Line, was one of the studies that we did because he'd been one of the tutors there at Harvard. And someone also added to it that there's times as a leader that you need to move from the dance floor up onto the balcony, but the stairs, and sometimes you're halfway up the stairs, having a look at both what's going on the dance floor. Well, you've got to relate to people and connect with them. You can't be some distant figure just giving occasional words from the gods. This voice comes from the balcony. And they go, Who's that? Where is it? So I heard it somewhere on the speakers. Yeah. But that you can relate to people by being back in the dance floor. But the temptation is to always go back to the guns, as they used to say, from the hilltop to what you used to know, which was firing the cannons rather than giving instructions to a whole range of other people.
And I think you're right. You have to be able to be at the same place, at both places at once in your mind. So that's a particularly good.
Have you seen this one?
Yeah, I've seen you doing that.
Those listening, someone taught me once that you extend your left arm as far as you can with the hand up, the sort of stop hand, and the other hand is just in front of your nose, and you move it back and forth, and you move them side to side. And at times, you've got to have these two visions that Andrew talks about, being able to see things close up, the tactical, but also way out there, 10 years, the strategic long-term aspirations that you have.
So you know, from your balcony, you're going to be in a proactive mode. You're going to be able to scan the horizon, look for the weak signals about what's coming next. And I think going back to that point at the beginning about disruptive technology, if you're thinking about today, you're probably behind the curve. I think what most CEOs want from their senior teams are people who can look around the corner. And I know we can't predict the future, but you can start to think in that space if you take up the option of getting to your balcony more.
Love it.
And then the last one, you know, just to finish off, and again, it reinforces what we spoke about before in terms of behavior, is the leader's shadow. And I think you and I will know that there are some leaders who have a very powerful shadow, and there are some leaders who have a very weak shadow. So what you say, what you do, what you prioritize, those all go into your leadership shadow. And it's almost like building a brand. Right, you want to have a leadership brand that you own, you control, and it's all based on that impact. And the thing that makes it quite tricky, again, going back to technology, is that you can't turn off your leadership shadow. It's with you 24/7. Every email you send, every tweet you might make, that is being picked up by people who are making a judgment about you. So I always say to people, be careful when you react to an email or you send a message and you think, oh, I wish I hadn't have said that. So taking that time to pause and stand back and think about what is the impact of this decision going to be, I think is a really important skill.
Yeah, and I do like the idea of the leadership shadow. Putting it together with North Star and balcony, being on the balcony is very powerful three shots. It's a really good analogy, which I'm sure people will listen to and take away. And this idea of the shadow, it can be both a very long shadow and a very positive one that you cast, but also it can be quite a scary shadow. Having quite a negative, you know, sometimes shadows can be scary and have a negative impact on how people feel and how they feel about you. And they may not say it. And so this is where 360 feedback is really important. And David Soule, the rugby, the Scottish rugby captain and coach himself, was saying, when we chatted the other day, he was saying that one of his FTSE 50 CEOs has a 360 done every year and he publishes it.
Really?
And he tells people the three areas he's working on. He publishes it. And I absolutely love that because that is That's vulnerability and that's transparency, but that's accountability.
Do you know what, Jonathan? I think I'm going to take that as a sort of takeaway myself and say senior leaders that I work with, not only would you like to have a 360, but would you be happy for it to be published? I think that'd be a great question.
No, it's fantastic. Love that one. So there's three shots. Okay. And now let's come back to service career, because, you know, your service career has shaped you massively. It does make you very different from many of the other leadership coaches. And today, as you know, the industry is swamped with people who go, oh, I'm a coach. I was in corporate life, but now I've changed. I'm working from home and I've done a course this weekend. I'm a coach, but you actually have a wealth of experience. So so who or what has influenced you into the leader that myself and other leaders who are lucky to have you advising them experience? What's happened?
I think the first thing I'd like to say about leadership and my experiences in the Royal Navy was, firstly, that you shouldn't think or attach leadership to rate or rank or position. Because I think if we're both honest, some of the best leadership I ever saw was from the junior cadre or elements, and especially our senior rates. Now, I was very fortunate that I had some great bosses, and they empowered me to do my job. They gave me the resources, the need, they set the North Star, and that's all I could ever wish for. But I mean, the people who really influence you, I think if most people are honest, are fairly few and far between. But the one person I will share a quick story with who was a great influence on me was actually a female officer, a lady called Caroline State. And the context here is Caroline was the very first female officer to be promoted to Commodore. So she broke the ceiling, the glass ceiling there. And she was also the first female commanding officer of the nuclear submarine base at Faslane Lane in Scotland. Now, this the story I'm going to tell is about goes back to 2010. Okay, so it's already 13 years old. But at the time, I was working in the MOD and Caroline was also a senior staff officer there. And I was asked by the Institute of Directors if I could source or find someone from the MOD who would be happy to come and give a talk on women in leadership, because it was quite a big topic at the time. So I had a chat with Caroline and I said, could you do me a big favour? Could you come and share some of your experiences, recent experiences? She was the Commodore of the base from 2004 to 2007. So she had a couple of years after that with me in the MOD. And I wanted her to share what it was like to be a female leader in charge of a major establishment. So she agreed and we went along to this big event. And what I remember, Jonathan, was there was about 15 speakers on the schedule. And everybody had about, I think, 20 minutes to say their piece. And on the agenda, we were second to last. So I immediately thought, right, okay, we've got the graveyard slot, the dreaded graveyard slot. So I hope Caroline can do a good job. And secretly, I just knew she would. Now, you have to picture this, all right? So it gets to sort of 3:30 in the afternoon. You can imagine, you know, most people are just flaked out in this conference room. Been some fantastic speeches, but you know what it's like. There's so many people running through. And I remember on the stage, the lady who presented previously was a very, very tiny lady. And Caroline is about 6 foot tall. So the microphone was about 2 feet lower than where, you know, it should be for her to talk into the mic. And she walked on the stage and she unscrewed the microphone. She lifted up the extension and she put her sort of arms on her side like this and said, good afternoon, everybody. My nickname is Big Bird. And at that time, everyone sort of laughed, but quite nervously. And she said, look, I would like to share with you a story about my first day in command of the nuclear submarine base in Scotland. And she proceeded to tell this story of driving into work And on the particular day that she was joining to take over, you got to imagine the submarine base in Scotland. There's a permanent nuclear disarmament peace camp there, and on the same day there was also a union strike. Okay, she drives in her open top sports car in civilian clothes, and the first thing that happens is her car gets pelted with eggs and flour and all sorts of things. So she arrived at the gate, and the Scottish MOD guard said, cleaners over there to the left for passes, base personnel over there, clearly indicating that Caroline was a cleaner. All right, so she followed the instruction and queued to get her base pass with all the cleaners, brushing off the debris from what had been thrown at her. And then she proceeded to her office. And she did most of her handover in the morning, and her relief had just gone off for lunch or something when she took a phone call. And the phone call was from a very angry ship's captain who said, I can't get away from the jetty because the guy who is operating the gangway is on strike. Can you come and help? So she didn't really have the answer, but she walked down to the jetty and she put on her safety helmet and she climbed 50 feet in the air to this sort of crane operator's hut. And she knocked on the glass door. And this guy must have had the fright of his life. You know, I think he was spat out his cup of tea and put his page down. And she said, oh, good morning. You know, I'm the new base commodore. Would you mind removing the brow, the gangway, so the ship can sail and get on time? Anyway, she told this story and everybody was in howls of laughter and thought, you know, what a great person. And her end message, Jonathan, was really quite provocative and quite strong. She said, look, you know, I probably had to strive harder than most to do a good job, but all I'll say to you is be yourself and do the best you can. Mm. And she got a standing ovation. And I think she's one of the very few presenters who walked out of that room, you know, with a real sort of spring in a step in the job she did.
Great woman.
The great corollary to that, though, Jonathan, the last bit of the story is to why was she a great influence on me? When I left in 2010, one of the first things I did was to run a course called Women in Leadership. And I was using some of the base facilities in Portsmouth. We actually put a group of senior women through what's called a sinking ship simulator. Mm. It's about conducting damage repair in ships. And it was a fantastic day. And I was looking to get a keynote speaker for the lunch to join us. And I said to Caroline, do you think the second in command of the Navy, would he join us for lunch? And she looked at me and she said, Andrew, why are you asking the second in command to talk about leadership? You know as much about leadership as anyone that I've met. So go ahead and do it yourself. Mm. And I'll tell you what, Jonathan, that was huge. Mm. Because not only did it give me, you know, belief, but it just set me on that path, which I think I've sort of glided along ever since.
Expectation theory. She believes, yeah. She expected you. Well, that's great. We're at the last couple of minutes.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So, beautiful story. We must get your friend Caroline on this podcast. Mm. One myth. You've been very good about teaching me about leadership myths.
Yeah.
If you would give us one leadership myth that you'd like to bust, what would it be? And then we'll do your top tip.
Okay. The thing that I hear that really irritates me is the classic command and control, just like they do in the military. You know, we're moving away from command and control and it's really about empowerment. This is what I hear in a lot of organizations or even other podcasts or books that I read. And I hope you'll agree, Jonathan, but my experience in the Royal Navy was that I never really felt there was command and control over me. Now, we all knew what the parameters were, and we knew that if someone said, get your head down, you got your head down, because there's a real reason to do that. But at no stage did I ever feel that there was a culture of command and control. And what's really interesting is that I've seen more command and control in all the organizations I've worked with, all the teams I've worked with, even to, you know, the extremes. So the myth I'd like to bust is that the military is not about command and control. It's about good leadership. It's about setting direction. It's about knowing what is the intent of your one-up, your superior, and it's about knowing what your team below you expect and want. So there you go. All right. No more command and control, please. It's about total empowerment, and I never ever felt anything other than empowered to do my job.
Yeah, I fully support that one. Lovely. Well, Adam, would you just introduce yourself, tell them about the role you're doing now and a little bit about your background, and give us your top leadership tip to end us with?
Yeah, so just to give me my top tip, and I thought I'd do this completely naturally, because the thing I was thinking about before was to say, don't go wrestling with pigs, or don't do pig wrestling. And I think you know the story, don't you? People might know the story that if you get into a fight in the mud with the pig's going to love fighting it, you're going to hate it, and you're going to lose anyway. So that was my first thought. But now I go back to what Caroline said. My top tip to all you, to all leaders, is be yourself and do it with skill.
Lovely. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for being on the Spiral Leadership Podcast. If we end perhaps with appreciating one quality about each other, my appreciation of you is that you have real presence and gravitas with a lovely mix of humility. And I think people who have you advising their top teams and their leaders are very lucky. So it's a real honor having you on. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. And I guess I will repay the compliment by saying that I just think you're the consummate professional, Jonathan. Your ability to stand in the background, but actually bring everybody to the fore and then share your knowledge and experience, I think is a real skill. And as you say, do it with humility and do it with a sense of pride. I know you've been there, you've done it, you've seen a lot of things. And I want to wish you every success for the future as well.
Thank you, Andrew.
Okay.
Speak again soon.
So now you've heard from one of the inspiring leaders that I've interviewed, what are you going to do next? If you want to get some more free material, go to my website, jonathanperks.com, or follow me on LinkedIn, Jonathan Bowman Perks. And there you can get access to my books, Inspiring Leadership and Top Tips for Inspiring Leaders. But if you want to actually do something about being a leader and constantly improving your game, raising your performance, get in touch with me about coaching you or one of your team that you want to raise the game for them. It's got to be people who want to be good to great, not people who you're trying to fire. And if you're looking for a motivational speaker, get in touch. Or if you want me to work with your team coach, I would be delighted to help you.